I'm Kathleen Dunn on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio for this Wednesday. This hour of the program, we're going to be talking with the author of Spies of Mississippi. This, as you know, because of yesterday's show, although you probably already knew it anyway, is the 50th anniversary of Freedom Summer. It's also Black History Month, so I think today will be a wonderful follow-up to the show that we did yesterday on Freedom Summer and on the tour that UW Waukesha Continuing Education is leading to civil rights historical interest places all over the South in June. The documentary, Spies of Mississippi, based on Rick's book, is going to premiere on the PBS series Independent Lens this coming Monday. And it's a really incredible story. It's the story of the Sovereignty Commission, which was started in Mississippi in 1956, 2 years and in direct response to the Board versus Brown Brown versus Board of Education decision. The governor started this as a propaganda outlet, a way for Mississippi to get the message out that segregation is actually preferred by both blacks and whites in Mississippi and is critical to maintaining the peace. It started out with propaganda films and then it went beyond that. And we're going to hear about what it was and who was affected by it and who knew about it and who collaborated. Rick has worked as a newspaper reporter and editor for a number of years, reporting for the Patriot Ledger of Quincy, Massachusetts, the Miami Herald, and USA Today. He has, over the past decade, directed multimedia projects telling socially relevant stories through print, the web, TV, radio, music, and drama. He has worked with AARP, the Leadership Conference on Civil Rights in the Library of Congress, in directing this important project, Voices of Civil Rights, gathering thousands of firsthand accounts of the civil rights movement to form the world's largest archive of testimonials from the era. We'll be welcoming phone calls for Rick. Our phone number is 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Our email is talk@wpr.org. Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. Hello, Rick. Thank you so much for being with us.
No, it's great to be here.
Not a very well-known story this is, but what a compelling story. Holy Toledo. It was really a gripping documentary, wasn't it, in your book as well?
Well, that's what kind of attracted me to this story. I remember just finding a little article about it on the internet, and a very obscure article, the kind that you would not just stumble upon. You had to search for it. And it referred to the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission, and then said that it was a special agency designed to preserve segregation, reported only to the governor, and created a network of spies who infiltrated civil rights groups. But beyond that, it kept its records. And there are 160,000 pages of spy reports that really detail the lengths that the state of Mississippi went to try to preserve its segregated system. And going through those files was just mind-blowing, is the only way I can describe it. They're tracking Martin Luther King. They're tracking Medgar Evers. They're intervening in court cases. They're ruining people's lives simply because they suspect they might be sympathetic to the cause of civil rights. So it just seemed like a story that needed to be told, and one that really reminded us of just what a brutal period that was, and also the role of the state in taking these extreme measures against their own citizenry. That's one of the reasons I really wanted to bring this story out, because I don't think people are at all aware of how the government, in this case in Mississippi, played such a big role in denying rights to people through intimidation, through blackmail, and through other tactics that went far beyond any reasonable place that the government should go.
Yeah, way beyond. Let's go back to 1956, 2 years after Brown versus the Board of Education. Mississippi, the white establishment in Mississippi, even though the state is, about 50% African-American, if not more in those years, decides they have to preserve their way of life. What are they talking about? What are they preserving? What do they want to preserve?
Well, what they wanted to preserve was segregation. So in Mississippi, everything was completely segregated. Even the county fair had 1 week for whites.
Really?
One week for blacks.
Oh, my gosh.
If you were to go fishing, if you were an African-American, you fished on the colored side of the lake.
Oh.
So it was a completely segregated society. And that system of segregation was what the state of Mississippi was adamantly dedicated to preserving. And with Brown versus Board of Education, with the NAACP picking up membership, with the Justice Department threatening to enforce voting rights, the state needed to do something dramatic. And one of the actions it took was to create a special agency that would report directly to the governor and that would have the powers to investigate private citizens, investigate organizations, keep secret files, and distribute propaganda to support this system that was starting to shake.
Mm-hmm. And you talk about the ramifications here and say that if you were on this list, if your name got on the watch list, if you rented from a white person and you were on the list, you were evicted perhaps. If you had a job and you were on the list, you probably were going to lose that job. These were pretty serious repercussions.
Yeah. Well, it was interesting. As you pointed out, at first, the commission was actually a propaganda service. So it's creating pamphlets that talk about the positive side of segregation, how both sides are really much happier
right.
under this system. And it creates films, and it has a speakers bureau. But it soon became apparent to the commission that that was not really going to do the job. So they began hiring these special agents. And these were former FBI investigators. These were former state police investigators. And they would conduct investigations into anyone who was even suspected of even sympathizing with the civil rights cause. So if they showed up at your house because they heard that you had attended an NAACP meeting, your name was on a list of people who were suspected members. And if you continued to go to those meetings, they might leak information about you to the local media.
Mm-hmm.
That local media will carry whatever story they tell. So there are going to be falsehoods in there, and it's going to make you look bad. But who reads those local newspapers? Well, in some cases, the Ku Klux Klan.
Mm.
So you had cases where the Sovereignty Commission could ruin your life. Yes, they could get you fired from your job by calling your employer. They could get you kicked out of your house by calling your landlord, but they could also publicize information about you that would bring you to the attention of people who worked with violence.
Mm. And they also published addresses, didn't they? Some of the papers?
Yep, they would publish names, addresses. So it was a tactic that the state used. One of the activists who was involved told me, the Sovereignty Commission didn't pull the trigger, but it did load the gun.
Mm-hmm.
And they were well aware of what could happen to people once that information got into the hands of the White Citizens Council or the Ku Klux Klan.
And tell me more about the Klan as there became more and more concerns about voting and people wanting to vote and people applauding Brown v. Board of Education and noticing the civil rights movement advancing. So all of a sudden, I think you say this, the Klan came back, and they came back with a vengeance.
Yeah, that's absolutely true. So really dating back to 54 and Brown versus Board of Education, there was a group in Mississippi called the White Citizens Council. And the White Citizens Council was kind of jokingly referred to as the Country Club Klan or the White Collar Klan. These were business leaders. These were community leaders who wore suits and ties instead of hoods and robes, but nonetheless were totally dedicated to preserving white rule and would use all these same tactics of getting people fired, etc. But as the civil rights movement continued to make gains, as more and more African Americans voted, and as more and more young people came down to Mississippi to help to register voters, the Ku Klux Klan revived its old tactics and came back on the scene with a vengeance.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the real sad things about the Sovereignty Commission and the role of the state was that it had a narrative to protect. Remember, it was telling the story that both sides are happier under our segregation system. Everything is fine down here in Mississippi because we have segregation. Well, that means they had to turn a blind eye to this reincarnation of the Klan. And they had ample evidence that this was happening, but they were focused on the other side of the equation.
Mm-hmm.
So the state actually was very complicit in many ways in allowing the Klan to come back into power, but also in funneling information to the Klan that ended up in violent acts against people.
Mm-hmm. So in some ways, the state was not directly responsible, but perhaps indirectly responsible for leading FBI agents and others astray for the search for the three civil rights workers who were murdered in Philadelphia, Mississippi. But they could bear some responsibility for the whole atmosphere that resulted in the deaths of not only those civil rights workers, but the deaths of other people as well.
Absolutely. In just that case, the case of Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney, those young people were at a training session in Ohio prior to coming down to Mississippi for Freedom Summer. The state of Mississippi took its number one black agent working in secret for the Sovereignty Commission, and that agent drove up to Ohio and participated in the training session as if he was an activist.
Oh, my gosh.
And everyone believed he was an activist, but every day, and these records exist and they're detailed, every day he would phone in a report to the commission. And he would send in materials from the session, including the names, descriptions, car, make and model, license numbers of the activists who were heading down into Mississippi. And what the Sovereignty Commission did with that information was to compile it into lists and share those lists with the county sheriff's departments. And in the case of providing that information to the county sheriff in Philadelphia, Mississippi, well, the county sheriff and the deputy were members of the Ku Klux Klan.
Mm.
So when Goodman, Schwerner, and Cheney arrived in Philadelphia, Mississippi to investigate a church bombing, their names were already on the list. And that list was provided by the state, recirculated by the White Citizens Council, which was a private white supremacist organization funded by the state.
Hmm.
The Citizens Council got much of its funding from the Sovereignty Commission. So it's not so much that the state is three steps back and indirectly involved. The state is actually making these things possible. And when the state does get involved, in the case of the Sovereignty Commission investigator who was they're shadowing the FBI in the investigation of where these three kids went to, he sided with the sheriff and the deputy and the other people who were involved and implicated in the crime. So he was sending reports back to the state saying, oh, the FBI is totally wrong. This is a complete hoax.
Oh, my gosh.
These kids weren't murdered.
Right.
They're somewhere in Cuba smoking cigars
right.
with Castro.
Yeah.
So the state is so deeply entwined
right.
in these kind of activities that it almost it boggles the mind, but it's also reminiscent of a police state.
Right, absolutely. And didn't the Sovereignty Commission have a piece of paper that had the burial site?
Yeah.
Of Cheney and Goodman and Schwerner. And so they knew while the FBI is conducting this search, you know, there's all this national media attention, the government knew that where they were buried.
Yeah, there was a, there's a very chilling document that is in the Sovereignty Commission file, and it is a picture, like stick figures, of three individuals, and it says Goodman, Schwerner, Cheney, 14 feet deep.
Gee.
So not only did they know the location,
oh.
they knew how deeply they were buried.
Oh.
And that was provided from the Sovereignty Commission investigator to the Sovereignty Commission right around the time the bodies were found. So it's unclear whether this is produced before or after. But either way, the commission was so close to the county sheriff, the deputy sheriff, and the other people in the Klan that they had better information than the FBI.
Mm. We're going to welcome phone calls. We want to talk about the role of informants. There were, in order for this to be as successful, quote, successful, unquote, as it was, there had to be African-American collaborators. And our guest in his book talks about a school superintendent from Mississippi River Delta who didn't want the black school system to go away because he knew that that would be the end of his job. So he volunteered to be a spy and then proposed that the state fund an alternative organization to the NAACP, which black people could join to oppose integration. I don't know how many would have joined that, but money speaks in many different ways. We will hear from someone who, from the film, describing why informants decided to become informants, and welcome your phone calls as well. I'm sure after yesterday's show, I know that many of you listening are really up to speed with your history of this time in our country, and probably we had some people call who had grown up in Mississippi and who felt that they're, because their fathers taught at the university, that they were unsafe in that state. Maybe some of you were there for Freedom Summer or would like to ask our guest questions about that whole time period. Rick Bowers is our guest, author of Spies of Mississippi. The documentary, same name, will premiere on the PBS series Independent Lens, and that's coming up this Monday evening, and very, very interesting and important piece of work. Did I give you the number? 800, what did I forget this? 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. Facebook page is The Kathleen Dunn Show. And this is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We have a few clips from the documentary, the TV documentary that will air this Monday, Spies of Mississippi, and this is an explanation from somebody who was there of why people decided to become informants in Mississippi. I thought you might want to hear a little bit of the documentary itself.
We had a lot of people who felt that there was no way that the civil rights movement could possibly win. So why not get on the winning side early? And others would say, well, the government asked me to do it. Therefore, it has to be legal. The government doesn't do illegal things, does it?
The government doesn't do illegal things, does it, Rick?
Well, I think we see that when the government gets the power of secrecy and kind of an unrestrained mission, it can redefine what legal is in its own mind. So I think the lesson that I took away from the research in Mississippi was that one thing leads to another in these cases, and in this case, the propaganda led to the spying, which led to the dirty tricks, which ruined lives. So I think at the core, it was the secrecy that was the issue.
You, I know, talked with, and I want you to talk a little bit more about the African-American agents who were needed. There were some interesting stories here. First, how important were they to make the Sovereignty Commission work? Who hired them, and were they able to remain secretive all the time, or did people find out who they were?
Yeah, well, there were two types. In the beginning, in the late 50s, the commission turned to African-American community leaders who might be more conservative than some of the quote-unquote agitators within the civil rights movement, and who realized that being on the good state of the state, good side of the state government was a positive thing for their careers and a positive thing for their lives. One of the examples of that type of informant was a preacher, Reverend Humes. And Reverend Humes had a Baptist church in Greenville. He rode a circuit of Baptist churches in the Delta, and he was what they called a whooping preacher. He brought fire and brimstone to every sermon. Well, he was not comfortable with the NAACP, and he agreed to become an informant to the commission. He would attend NAACP meetings. He would take copious notes of what went on. He would send detailed reports back to the state, naming new NAACP members, new leaders rising to the top. The next time Martin Luther King was visiting Mississippi, Reverend Humes would make sure the state was aware and was aware of the parade route that the demonstration planned to take. And Reverend Humes was paid handsomely for his duties to the state. He had a $150 a month stipend, plus he got extra money for each report. And he became the number one source of information for the Sovereignty Commission in the Delta. Now, in that case, eventually there was a newspaper article when the Associated Press discovered a check from the Sovereignty Commission to Reverend Humes for the cause of quote-unquote investigations. And it actually triggered quite an uproar in the black community. There were calls for him to be taken out of the role of president of the Baptist Convention. People criticized him for being a traitor. But the cat was out of the bag. Now people knew that not only were there white agents investigating the civil rights movement, but even within the meetings themselves, the information being discussed was not safe.
Mm-hmm. And what about the press in this time, Rick? Obviously, people got alerted to what was going on after the murders of the civil rights workers, and it became international news. But I've heard that before that, there just wasn't a whole lot of attention paid, or were there some enterprising reporters from Mississippi who were doing investigative work of what was going on with this secret society, this
There was virtually none of that.
Nothing. Wow.
So for the most part, every major newspaper in the state was a segregationist newspaper. Mm. So the only information they would provide to their readers was from the point of view of segregation. And the Sovereignty Commission was actually able to use these newspapers as a tool to publish its propaganda. Now, there was one newspaper, the Delta Democrat Times in Greenville, Mississippi. Hodding Carter was the editor.
Oh, sure.
And he was a firebrand of an individual. who was not afraid of this state apparatus. And he did publish articles condemning some of this. He warned that the rise of the White Citizens Council was going to turn into violence. And he really favored a more moderate course. In fact, there's a funny story about him. At one point, the White Citizens Council burned his figure in effigy, kind of a stuffed doll that looked like Hodding Carter, and they burned it over a bonfire created by copies of his newspaper. And he wrote a front-page editorial the next day saying, "We're making so much progress in the state of Mississippi because we used to burn real people."
Oh, no.
So he had a way of taking on his adversaries with the written word. But aside from him, that was it. There was no other voice in Mississippi that represented the movement in anything but a negative tone, except for the wire services. Their articles would be neutral. That's why AP had to break the story of the black spy. And on top of that, and this goes to this whole milieu in Mississippi, the number one black journalist in the state, Percy Green, editor of the Jackson Advocate, a weekly newspaper for African Americans, was an informant for the Sovereignty Commission.
Oh, for heaven's sake.
So he was on the dole, being paid for information about all the sources he had within the civil rights movement.
Oh.
So it was a closed society. It was a society where there was no real debate. There was no real discussion. There was no real balanced information. And the state apparatus was so powerful that no one could complain.
Mm-hmm.
So that was the reality.
So was it, was it the press and the attention to the murder of the civil rights workers that, and then the subsequent Voting Rights Act that changed all of this?
Yeah.
Or that was what did it?
That's what did it. By 1964, things are truly changing in America.
Mm-hmm.
And Mississippi is still hanging on to this old system, hanging on to these old beliefs. But the fact that three civil rights workers, two from New York, go to Mississippi for the simple purpose of registering black people to vote, and the day they get there, they're taken out and murdered by the Ku Klux Klan, who also happened to be the local police. This became international news. Even President Johnson had to get involved in this. The FBI was sent down to break up the Klan once and for all. And some of that closed society was now visible to the external world.
Mm-hmm.
That was a real shifting point. And even the major politicians of the day stated at that time that it was a change point and that the state had played a role in all of this.
Mm. So they took all those tens of thousands of pages of notes that they gleaned from spying on their citizens and stuffed them away in a vault somewhere. Mm-hmm. And did anybody, and then finally they were discovered some decades after, which was the basis for your book and for this documentary. How were they discovered?
Well, there was a suit filed by the ACLU in Mississippi demanding that the records be made public. And, of course, the state legislators did not want that to happen since most of their names are in those files.
Yeah, right.
So there was a real effort by the state to try to lock those away or destroy them. But the courts sided with the people who wanted those files made public, and they were made public in 1998. And one of the amazing things is even after they were made public, they were not publicized outside of Mississippi very much. So the greater United States really has not heard this entire story.
Right.
But the records just opened the book on what really went on. and you got to see the different layers of it. So there was the intervention into the big historic cases, the murder of Medgar Evers, where the Sovereignty Commission aided the defense. They aided the murderer while the state was prosecuting him. You know, the involvement in the Goodman, Schwerner, Cheney case. But then there was also the day-to-day events where they would investigate a report that a woman had a child that looked black, and a Sovereignty Commission agent would show up and examine that child to determine if it was more than 1/16th black.
Oh, my gosh.
If it was, that child had to go to a black school. If it wasn't, it could go to a white school. But there were kids where the Sovereignty Commission couldn't decide who never went to school at all. So you started to see this closed system, and you started to see 87,000 names of individuals that have investigative files. So 87,000 people were investigated by the state of Mississippi for possibly supporting civil rights. So once those files were opened, the story began to be told. And a very important aspect of it is there's a reporter in Mississippi named Jerry Mitchell at the Jackson Clarion Ledger who actually got access to these files before they were opened and started writing articles about it. And those articles actually resulted in things like the retrial of Byron D. LeBeckwith for the murder of Medgar Evers. So when it was found out that the Sovereignty Commission intervened in that case on the side of the defense, D. LeBeckwith was retried and found guilty. And that's actually happened a number of times now where these files has forced prosecutors to go back and reopen cases because the state was actively intervening on the side of Klansmen who found themselves as defendants in murder cases.
Wow. What a time in our history. What a time in Mississippi, huh? Rick Bowers is our guest this hour. He's the author of the book, Spies of Mississippi, and the documentary done by Independent Lens will be on PBS this Monday. It's an hour-long documentary, and it looks at the Sovereignty Commission and fascinating stories by informants, the extent of the state involvement in really horrendous activities of trying to deny people their right to be a human being, and the state's collusion with the Ku Klux Klan and with sheriff departments who were 50% members of the Ku Klux Klan. We have to hear the story of the NAACP attempt to integrate one of the colleges in Mississippi and what they did to this young man who had a perfect record. They had to plant evidence. And also, we have to talk about, because we're concerned, some people are concerned about spying on American citizens now. They spend some time in the film with Bernie Thompson, U.S. representative from Mississippi's 2nd District, who served as chair of the House Homeland Security Committee. He knew what his state government was capable of doing. Are there things that have national significance here, too? Can we look at Mississippi and say, this is what we've learned from what happened there? We got to make sure this doesn't happen again. We welcome your phone calls if you'd like to join us. I know you haven't seen the documentary. I feel like I'm in special company, just my own company, because I watched it last night. But it will be on Monday. But some of you, I'm sure, know this story. You've read the book, or you just have questions about it. If you're hearing for the first time, feel free to join us. 800-486-8655. 800-486-8655. Email talk at WPR.org. And our Facebook page is the Kathleen Dunn Show. This is the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. We wanted to have you have a chance to hear just a little bit more of this documentary. When we were talking about Freedom Summer yesterday and again today, these were the warnings that the young people who were being trained in Ohio who were about to go to Mississippi, this is what they heard, which most unfortunately turned out to be ever so true.
The training in Ohio that we were doing for the young people that was coming for the 1964 Summer Project lasts for 2 weeks. The training had to do with preparing them for coming into Mississippi. Those three things you needed to be prepared for was to be beaten, to be put in jail, and to be killed. And if you're not prepared for all three of those, we won't hold it against you if you decide not to come.
That's from the documentary, which, as we've said, will air this Monday, Spies of Mississippi. Let's welcome phone calls for our guest. Jack in Eau Claire is our first caller. Hi, Jack.
Hi there. Hopefully I won't lose you. I'm actually on the North Shore of Minnesota right now.
Oh, okay.
As a law enforcement, retired law enforcement, I always wondered, I was always amazed at some of these people. You talk about the treasure trove of information that they got in the Sovereignty Commission's records. Why they don't destroy these, or what efforts weren't made to get rid of those records. I mean, at some point in time, accidents happen, evidence disappears. And the fact beyond it is.
And you just disappeared too, I'm afraid. but we got the question.
Though.
It is, yes.
It's a great question. And actually, some of the files have disappeared. Mm. So we don't have the full story of the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission, because almost certainly that is not a complete set of files, and possibly some of the more sensitive things never made it into those files. But there are still 160,000 pages of spy reports. So it creates a fairly complete picture of what went on. I think in the case of the Sovereignty Commission, the people involved in it, the director, never believed that the side of the segregated state would lose the struggle. And they never believed that the public would demand that these files be made public. So they kept these files. They didn't keep meticulous files. A lot of the names are misspelled and misfiled, but nonetheless, they kept these records. And once the Sovereignty Commission was finally abolished, the records just sat there for 20 years and were forgotten. So, for whatever reasons, probably having to do with arrogance, these files were kept. And the state tried in every way possible to keep these files from ever being made public. So there were bills proposed in the state legislature to keep them locked up. But the courts intervened and decided they need to be made public. And not only are they public, but they're all classified and available online through the State of Mississippi Archive Department.
I'm wondering, and I think that Jack wanted to ask a follow-up about potential spying now. I was interested in the comments in the documentary from Bernie Thompson, the representative from Mississippi's 2nd District who served as chair of the House Homeland Security Committee. I think he says this was the largest spying operation we've had since 9/11. Did he express, or has anybody expressed in the work that you've done, concerns that the NSA spying bears some resemblance to what happened in Mississippi, or are we dealing with two different things?
No, I think almost everybody who came under the scrutiny of the Mississippi State Sovereignty Commission is concerned that this can be revived again in a different form.
Mm.
And I think Bernie Thompson would agree with that, and certainly in his role, formerly head of the Homeland Security Committee, he has kept that foremost in his mind. And the fact is that even if you look at the model of this Sovereignty Commission, it has reoccurred. In the state of Maryland, in my hometown area, state police investigators began infiltrating anti-war groups in Tacoma Park, Maryland. They would show up at the meetings. They would pose as activists. They would take down all the names. And there was a file at the state police department of all the people in Tacoma Park who were joining these organizations. In the state of Pennsylvania, a similar thing happened, where the state government farmed out its security to an outside firm. And that firm started compiling the names of people who had joined organizations that opposed certain environmentally sensitive tactics by drilling companies. So they were compiling a list of activists in an area that they thought might be disturbing to the state's interest. So it happens over and over again, and now with the power of electronic surveillance,
yes,
and the power to track people via their cell phones and internet computers, you know, the opportunity for abuse is greater than ever.
Yeah.
So I think the real issue becomes the secrecy issue. And what we need is detailed information about what's allowed and what's not allowed. And then we need investigative reporters who can go tell us about the cases where people are going over the line.
Mm-hmm.
But without that, it's almost guaranteed that this will recur. Mm-hmm. And just like these people in Mississippi, these little people who might have joined the NAACP, but they weren't real activists, their lives still got ruined because the power of the state is so much greater than a single individual.
Tell us,
I think eternal vigilance in this particular case is the way to go.
In talking about, there are examples in the film of people's lives being ruined. Talk about, I can't remember his name off the top of my head, the young man who was trying to apply African-American to a white college. Perfect background, lovely person, and what happened to him?
Well, this is one of the saddest cases in the history of the civil rights movement. And one of my reasons for writing the book and working on the film was to make this name known because this person was a true American hero. Mm. But his name was Claude Kinnard. He was born in Hattiesburg, Mississippi. At a young age, his family sent him north to Chicago so that he might attend a decent school. He went on to join the military, became a paratrooper, was decorated for his service in Korea, left the military with an honorable discharge, and went to the University of Chicago for 2 years. Outstanding student. His mother became ill, and he had to return to Hattiesburg, Mississippi, to help her on her farm. Right down the road from his farm in Hattiesburg is Mississippi Southern College. So naturally, he figures he'll finish his degree at Mississippi Southern College. But he's a black man applying to enter an all-white college in Mississippi before James Meredith. So the Sovereignty Commission took a great interest in this case and tracked him relentlessly. Mm. His file is an inch thick.
Oh, no.
They talked to everyone he knew in Hattiesburg. They talked to everyone he knew in Chicago. They talked to everyone he came in contact with in the military. They went to his bank, searched his bank records. They did everything in their power to find something negative on this person to use against him in his application for college, and they couldn't find anything because he was a good guy.
Mm-hmm.
So what happened was that after he left the admissions office, after being refused admission to the college, not refused by the chancellor, but the chancellor and the Sovereignty Commission investigator together. He was pulled over by the police, and lo and behold, they found liquor in his back seat.
Mm.
And they framed him on that charge, and that ended his quest to try to get into the college for a while. Then he tried again. And then he was accused of being a party to a theft, the theft of 5 bags of chicken feed from a cooperative. And he was found guilty. They actually elevated the value of the chicken feed to $25 because that constituted a felony. He was sentenced to 7 years hard labor at Parchman Penitentiary. And he would he was in prison. Because he was literate, he would write letters home for the other prisoners. He would teach them how to read and write. But unfortunately, he was diagnosed with cancer. He was released, but only a month before he died. and only released to avoid the bad publicity of a political prisoner dying in custody. So Clyde Kinnard never got to attend that college, and he suffered greatly because of the effort put against him by our own government. And it was years later, many years later, like half a century later, that the person who testified against him at the trial on the chicken feed recanted and said, no, he had no involvement. They made me do it as a way to stop him from going to college. And his name was cleared, and they even have Clyde Kinnard Day in Mississippi, but his story is unknown in the annals of the civil rights movement, but right. It should be known.
It should be known. I'm glad you told that story. That is, on every possible level, what they did to him because he wanted to go to college.
Yeah.
All right. Jack, thanks very much for your call. Wherever you are now, safe travels to you. Frank in Onalaska is next. Hi, Frank.
Hello.
Hello.
Can you hear me?
Yes, sir.
Yes, you know, and those stories are tragic. And whenever I think of, you know, a book like this, the movie, the stories that, you know, target the people that have instigated what to me is criminal action, what are the consequences to the lives of, you know, and I guess I'll use these white people. I mean, I assume that's generally who they are, but obviously there's been some, you know, black African Americans that were involved in this type of spying and conspiracy as well. With your book and the movie and the stories, what are the consequences to these people that have acted this way? Certainly their lives should be affected by these revelations. Maybe revenge isn't exactly what I have in mind, but, you know, they should pay some consequences for the suffering that they imposed on these people.
Well, I think that's a great point. But the reality in Mississippi is that this was statewide, that the entire state government was complicit in this. Virtually every member of the state legislature voted for the Sovereignty Commission and supported these activities. So it's very difficult for the official state apparatus in Mississippi to own up to its crimes, and they never really have. And even to this day, as you'll see in the film, the former members of the Sovereignty Commission, the one in the film,
yes,
still feels that it was the right thing to do,
yeah,
that we had to take this action because we were under attack from outside forces. Mm. And, you know, he told me I enjoyed hiring those spies and throwing those kids in jail. So the reality is that at least in Mississippi, there has been very little reconciliation. Now, I will say it's a completely different place than it was back then, but all of this still lingers. And in my research, I actually found families who are still divided because one side of the family worked for the Sovereignty Commission and the other side was involved in the civil rights activities. So it's a tragic case, and there are people trying to bring some reconciliation to this. But step one is to just recognize the truth. This occurred. You know, it's unfortunate. It shouldn't have, but it did. And I just think that's part of it. But I don't want to be totally negative, and I will say if you go to Mississippi today, it is a completely different case. I remember sitting in this restaurant, and there was a, like, 16-year-old boy, and he had his arm around his African-American girlfriend. And I don't think he knew, but if he did that 40 years earlier, he was a dead man.
He sure was.
So it's changed dramatically, but the legacy is still there.
Yeah. and it needs to be known. And thanks to you for letting us know. Rick, thank you so much for being with us.
Sure thing.
Rick Bowers, our guest. His book is the basis of the documentary that's going to be airing this Monday evening on PBS. It's the PBS series Independent Lens. Check your local listings, as they say, to find out exactly what time it's going to be on. The title is Spies of Mississippi. Thanks to K.P. Whaley for producing this hour. Thank you, everybody, for all of your calls. Great conversations ahead, and we'll be with you again tomorrow at 1 o'clock here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio.